architecture. So not just a matter of the whole culture being expressed, but maybe personal or individual values being expressed in the architecture. So I think any design problem, and this is probably true of any arts situation, any design problem is not a determinate problem. There is not one solution to the problem. So that's true if you're writing a piece of music, it's true if you're doing a film, it's true if you're doing a dance. There's not one way to do it, there's not one answer to that. So if you probably remember, maybe sixth grade math, they talk about determinate and indeterminate equations. So a determinate equation is like 2x equals 10. So x equals 5, right? There's one answer, very clear, one and only one answer. But an indeterminate equation is where there are many different possible answers. So like 2x plus 3y plus z equals 35. You could find any number of combinations of x, y, and z that would solve that problem. So that's a more indeterminate situation. And arts problems are indeterminate problems. There are many solutions to the problem. And if I, for instance, gave all of you the very simplest architectural design problem. Let's design a doghouse. And I told you exactly, what kind of pooch you're supposed to be accommodating and what his sleep and activity patterns were and how much money you have to spend and what materials you can use and where it's going to be located and what the climate is, so you don't want the pooch frying in his little doggy house and you don't want him freezing in the winter and how you can maximize that. If I gave you all of those facts about the problem and I said, okay, design a little doggy house, I would have dozens and dozens and dozens of very, very different designs that came out of that. And that's because it's an indeterminate problem. Now, how is it that any individual within that situation determines what kind of design they're going to have? And I would say in the very best of instances, a person is figuring out what are my values? What do I believe in? What's important to me? And they use those values to apply to the situation. And that's what gives them an answer. Now, in architecture, we do get an answer. Solid, brick, mortars, there's an answer. So we have an indeterminate problem, we get to an answer. How do we get there? I think at the very best, it's that the individual designer brings their own, we could call it theory, philosophy, principles, prejudices, values, any of those things that the designer brings to the problem, and that begins to get closure. That begins to give a direction to the design solution. So that then brings us to the question, well, how do individual designers get different values? Why would one person design something one way and somebody else would design it a very different way? Why would they have different values? And it's the same as our political values. I mean, somebody running for office, they say, I'm a conservative. I believe in tight fiscal constraints. I believe in no waste. I believe in every individual going out there and doing their own work, and I don't believe in having a kind of safety net for them. They're on their own. And then there might be another politician that says, we're an affluent society. We should share our goods. We should share our wealth. Some people are disadvantaged. Some people are advantaged. We should try to equalize that through taxes. And those are completely different value systems. And that's how, presumably, political decisions are made. Those values are applied to indeterminate problems by politicians, and they come up with a solution. And so all of us, if I ask you what is your political persuasion, probably most of you have some values, some prejudices, some theories that you would apply to your political decisions. If I ask you about your social values, your social mores, do you believe in abortion? Do you not believe in abortion? Do you believe in gay marriage? Do you not believe in gay marriage? Probably you would have values you bring in that regard. And I'm telling you that you should also have architectural values. What are the things you believe in as regards the physical environment? And it's very hard for you individually to assess architecture, to consume architecture, to use architecture, without kind of understanding what are your values. Now, I said early in the class that this is not one size fits all. It's an arts class. That means that each of you are meant to have different attitudes or responses or whatever. And so that will likely happen here. So I'm asking you to, as we go through class today, to think of your own values, principles, prejudices, ideas about architecture. Maybe something you've never thought of before. And obviously through the semester we'll be refining those and you'll be learning more and you'll be able to hone that and make it a lot more mature. But today your Twitter card question is going to ask you to just tell me one little value you bring to architecture. One thing you think is important in architecture. And don't write it now. Just think about it while we're going through class. You'll get a lot of possibilities. And then at the end of class, that's going to be the Twitter card question. Now, all of that begins with, you know, you have some experience of architecture, some accounting of architecture that you've had through your life so far. And that's one way you come to these values. But I would say there are three primary ways that people get the values they have about architecture. The first thing is sometimes it just has to do with our personality. If someone is a quiet, reticent person, they may have certain preferences that would be really different from someone who was a very outgoing, very vocal, very in-your-face kind of person. Someone who was very compassionate and very gentle might have very different values than someone who was very violent, very aggressive. These personal traits sometimes incline us towards certain values or other values. So one thing that determines values is one's personality. A second thing that determines values is maybe the places somebody has been exposed to. If you, we talked about last time, if you grew up in Buda, Texas, or let's take it even more extreme, if you grew up in Muleshoe, Texas, and you'd pretty much lived there all your life, and it's a small town, and it's out in the middle of nowhere, and you never traveled much, your experience of those places would give you certain values about what you thought was important in the physical environment. As opposed to someone maybe who grew up in L.A., and this big, crazy, dynamic, freeway-driven city, and they had a completely different experience of space and of activities and interpersonal interactions, and they would have a different set of values. So what places you've lived in or you've visited or you've traveled or you've experienced, these certainly would affect your values. And then the third thing is the time you live in affects your values. There's always kind of something in the air, something in the ether, something that is in our general cultural milieu that affects our values. So, for example, these days we worry about energy consumption and sustainability. Maybe 25 years ago, that might not have been a very big issue, but now we understand limited resources and we start to make that a priority. And that might affect your values because of the time you live in and the issues that are prevalent in that time. So those three things, personality, places you've experienced, and the time you live in, all affect your architectural values. And of course, if you're a designer, if you're an architect, this is critically, critically important. This is actually how you go about solving design problems, is bringing those values, those ideas, to the indeterminate problem and then trying to find a solution according to those values. So today we're going to be looking at three architects. They all lived in exactly the same place at exactly the same time. They came from very different backgrounds. They had very different personalities. But we're going to look at the values they brought to architecture. And then we're going to look at, well, how did that affect the buildings they did? What kind of buildings come out of those values? And in looking at that through class today, that may help you get some ideas about what are my own values? What in this do I respond to? What in this is disgusting to me or revolting to me? So the three people we're going to look at are three German guys who lived in Berlin in the 1930s. And they all would have known each other. And they all would have been very prominent voices in this city of Berlin in the 1930s. And this was a real hotbed for architectural ideas in Berlin. It was one of the great capitals of Europe at the time, and especially interested in architecture in that era in the 1930s. So the first of these is a guy named Hugo Herring, and you'll see on your handout today, he's the first guy who was listed as architect there. Hugo Herring was a little bitty, shrimpy, short guy, and he was not an attractive man, but he was this very charismatic, very vibrant, very vocal architect. And in Berlin at the time, and really all over Germany, they had these little architecture clubs. And it often was associated maybe with arts and artists and other designers. And there was one in Berlin called Der Ring. And Hugo Herring was like the big guy in Der Ring. He was secretary, he was president. They did exhibitions and they did publications. And he was very, very involved in that. He wrote in the publications. He was just a very active kind of shaker and mover in Berlin at the time. And I would say that he had two kind of broad cultural values. One value is that Hugo Herring believed that society depends on individuals. The way we move a culture forward is that we optimize the performance of all the individuals within that culture. So we're never going to get anywhere unless we really emphasize each person being the most productive, the most vibrant, the best educated that they can possibly be. So he had a very democratic attitude. A second kind of societal value he had was he believed that nature is man's great teacher. He loved to take walks in the woods and just be inspired by the beauty of nature, by the integration of all the systems in nature, by the science of nature. All of these things fascinated him and believed that we as human beings really need to learn from the natural environment. So those are kind of the overarching values. And then I would say there were five architectural values that he brought to the table. One is he believed that design is a very intuitive and emotional process. I can't really be designing well if I'm not in the right mindset, the right mood for it. So sometimes he would play music to put himself in the right frame of mind. Sometimes he would go take a walk in the woods or something like that to inspire him, to put him in the right emotional state. But he felt like design was an emotional, intuitive process. Second architectural value, he believed that beauty is relative. We can't say something is beautiful for all people. If a little girl, 4 or 5 years old, she finds a little mangy, neglected puppy dog, and she cuddles it, and she says, oh, what a beautiful little puppy. Well, he may be mangy and a mutt, but to her, he's beautiful, and that is fine. That's beauty is relative. A third value is that he believed that each building has its own unique character. That when we come to a particular instance and we find a site and we find a function and we find people that are going to be using it, and that inspires a very, very particular, very customized, very unique character to each building. A fourth architectural value, he believed that function is above all the driver of all architecture. We have to understand the activities, the behaviors, what's going on there. That's what shapes architecture. And the fifth and final architectural value is he believed that expression is the second most important thing, and that expression should be linked to function. So what a building is all about is expressing the functions, the behaviors, the activities of the people that are in there. Now, you can see a kind of nice package of ideas about individualism, about expression of activity and behavior of individuals, about an architecture that is really founded on individuality. So think of Hugo. We're going to put him over on the side over here for a minute, and we'll come back and look at his work in a few minutes. A very good friend of Hugo Herring's was a guy named Mies van der Rohe. He's also listed there. You can see how it's spelled. Mies van der Rohe was almost the opposite of Hugo Herring in terms of how he looked. He was a very tall, very elegant, very handsome man in his youth, a real ladies' man. Women just kind of, you know, thought he was so cool. He was a kind of aristocratic guy. He had a very kind of noble bearing. He also was a man of few words. He just didn't speak up much, very, very quiet guy. He immigrated to the United States when he was in his early 40s. He fled Hitler's rule in Germany. And when he came to the United States, people were really struck by, this guy never says anything. He's just like a rock. And they thought, okay, well, maybe he's not so comfortable in English because he's, you know, German. But the people who knew him in Germany said, no, he didn't say anything when he was in Germany either. I mean, he just doesn't talk. So he's a very, very kind of soft-spoken man of few words. So he also had some kind of larger values, societal values. He believed that society depends on its institutions. You know, you just can't optimize every individual's performance. That's overwhelming. But what you do in a society is you build great institutions. You build great educational institutions like universities. You build great financial institutions like banks. You build great productive institutions like corporations. And that's really where we advance our society and our culture, by building these great institutions. So he would have had a different philosophy significantly than Hugo Herring there. He also believed that Western tradition in literature and in philosophy and in ethics, that is man's great teacher. You need to look at the classics. You need to look at, you know, the great lineage of philosophy and thinking and literature. He was a big fan of several philosophers in particular. That's where we see the light. That's where we move ahead. He would not have taken a little walk in the woods to try to find out what's profound and what's important. He would look to great literature or great thinking of Western tradition. So those are his two kind of overriding values. He also had five kind of architectural values. The first of these was that he thought the design was a very analytical process, not intuitive. You think it through, you reason it, you analyze, you get data, you absorb it, you deal with it. It's not quite scientific, but it certainly is analytical, the design process. Second value, he believed actually that beauty is universal, that if that little kid thinks that dog is beautiful, that little kid is wrong. That's a mangy, ugly dog. There are some standards we can apply of beauty, and it's fairly universal. A third architectural value, he would have believed that there are ideals of architecture that can be very broadly applied. Each building need not be unique. There are some characteristics that can be applied to maybe even all your buildings. I have slides of a art museum that he did in Berlin at about the same time as he was doing a corporate headquarters for Bacardi Rum in Havana. And if I don't look really closely, I get those slides mixed up because the buildings look pretty much alike. One is a museum, one is a corporate headquarters, one is in Berlin, one is in Havana. Very, very different circumstances, but Mies van der Rohe would have believed that there are broad principles of architecture that can be applied almost universally. He was famous for saying, I can't make a new architecture every Monday morning. Each building is not going to be unique. A fourth architectural value, Mies van der Rohe believed that construction and structure are the great generators of architecture. You don't design the building and then figure out how you're going to make it stand up or how you're going to construct it. The actual structure and construction of the building are the generative forces that shape the design. So you have to think about forces and construction and all of those things as the generators of architectural form. And then the fifth and final value, he believed that architecture should be an expression of its age, of its era. And his era, he thought, was about the Industrial Revolution, about the machine age, and that architecture needed to express that mechanization, that movement forward that the Industrial Revolution had produced. Okay, now the interesting thing about Hugo Herring and Mies van der Rohe, they were very, very good friends. Obviously, they were really different human beings. But even for a while, they shared an office in Berlin. They weren't working on the same projects. They had their own work individually. But one of them sitting on this side of the room, the other one sitting on the other side of the room, and they're doing work that's very, very different, but in the same room and in the same office and being very, very close friends. Okay, the third person we're going to look at is a guy named Albert Speer, S-P-E-E-R. Anybody know who Albert Speer was? Yeah. Yeah, he was Hitler's architect in Nazi Germany. And turns out that Hitler actually started out in school as an architecture student. And he went through architecture school for 2 years as an undergraduate. And then they had a kind of review of all the students after 2 years to see if they should go on. And he was told by the faculty that he didn't have what it took to be an architect and he should not continue in architecture. And he was actually really devastated by that because that was his vision of who he was going to be. He was going to be an architect. And so he sat down, thought about it. Okay, I can't be an architect. What shall I do with my life? Okay, maybe I'll rule the world instead. Second choice, but okay, we'll see if we can make that work. But he continued to have a very passionate interest in architecture. And when he began to get some power in Germany in the early 1930s, he hired one of his professors, actually one of the guys who said he shouldn't go on. But he hired him to do the work, the buildings that were associated with the areas of government that he was controlling. And that guy worked for Hitler for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. They had a very good relationship. Some interesting buildings came of that. And then his architecture professor, who was a generation or so older than he was, had a heart attack and died just like that. And at that point, Hitler was kind of depending on this guy, and suddenly he's gone. So Hitler kind of sends people out and says, okay, I want you to find the best architect to replace him. And so they bring in this young guy, Albert Speer, and they tested him on this one project, and he did really well, and he became Hitler's architect for the rest of the Nazi regime, and did many, many buildings. Now, at the end of that period, they were fighting the war so completely that they weren't doing much building. All the energy was going into armaments. And so Albert Speer got reassigned. He was so much in the inner circle there that he got reassigned to be the Minister of Armaments. That meant he sort of led the supply line for ammunition and arms and so on. So he got reassigned, not being an architect anymore. And then after they lost the war, then he was convicted of war crimes and was sentenced to spend pretty much the rest of his life in Nuremberg prison. And he wrote two very interesting books, one called Inside the Third Reich, about his period with Hitler, and the other one called Spandau I Remember, which was about his years in prison. So very interesting man. We could certainly curse the regime he was a part of, but he was a very, very talented architect, and he had very strong values. So his kind of two universal values would be, number one, that society depends on its leaders. It's not all the little hoi polloi individuals. It's not the institutions. It's great, charismatic leaders. That's how a society goes forward. And he believed that Hitler was that sort of leader, that we need to follow relatively blindly, because they know where this society should be going. Another kind of universal value is that he believed that fate is the great controller of human destiny. That, you know, you think you're making decisions about your life, you're not really. There is a path laid out for you, and you just follow it. I mean, fate is a great determinant of where you go and what you do. So he, especially in these books in his later life, he's very philosophical about things just happen the way they're going to happen, and you're not in control of that. He would have had five architectural values as well. The first of those, he believed that architecture is all about creating wonder and beauty and awe. It should like knock you on your ass. That's what architecture really is that drama, that moment of awe. And so he certainly wanted that to happen in his buildings. A second architectural value, he believed that buildings should express their own kind of role in the larger picture of a society. So a home should be fairly modest. A governmental building should be really, really powerful and kind of in your face. An industrial building should be very, very functional and clean and efficient. Each different building would have its own expression depending on its general role. A third architectural value, he believed that design is a way of communicating ideas. So this is really a tool for transferring social and intellectual ideas. And he used his buildings very much to do that. A fourth architectural value, he believed that architecture is a means to greatness and to posterity. He thought you could become immortal by being an architect, that the building should last and last and last hundreds, thousands of years into the future, and that was really attractive to him about architecture, that ability to affect posterity with buildings. And then the fifth and final value, he believed that architecture needed to be inspired by the great classical periods, Greece and Rome in particular, because they were the ones that had achieved all these other things, built those buildings that were just awe-inspiring. And they had buildings that lasted for eons and generations, and you could see that culture embodied in those buildings 1,000 years later. It was Greece and Rome that got it right, and we needed to learn from them. So you can see that all three of these guys had totally different perspectives, and that led to very, very different kinds of architecture that they produced. Now, Mies van der Rohe and Hugo Herring were a good 10, 15 years older than Albert Speer. Albert Speer was a very young guy in this period that we're going to be seeing them in Berlin at the same time. But he had been born to a very wealthy family, a very prominent family. His uncle had been one of the most prominent architects in Germany. He was privileged, and so he actually came to prominence at a very young age, whereas Mies and Hugo Herring, it took him a little longer. So he's a good bit younger than the other two. So let's look at the work these guys did. So this is not advancing the slide for some reason. So the first picture that's going to pop up there in a minute is a picture of Hugo Herring. Hugo Herring is, like I said, not exactly a suave dude. He's actually kind of goofy looking. He's going to come up in a minute. Can you just advance it? Okay, there he is. Poor old Hugo. You want to check that out? If you could advance again. The work that he did in his early career, well, this is a competition that he entered. The building didn't get built. But it was for the Friedrichstrasse railway station in downtown Berlin. That station's still there in what was the old East Berlin. But this is going to be a whole new station for this big subway and train hub in Berlin. And so he's thinking of his values. His values are that, you know, you're expressing the function. The function is all these people getting off the train, surging and moving crowds of people, you know, back and forth and around and through. And so the building takes this very organic, very flowing shape, just like the flowing quality of the movement of people in it. This is a building that is was also done in his early career. It's called the Secession Building. The Secession Group was another one of those kind of clubs like Dering was, that he was a member of. And this particular group had a lot of exhibitions, and they had a lot of lectures. And then they would have meetings of different people within the group. And so this would be the space that they would use for that. And you can see you would have entered the building right up through here, and then you would come in a lobby. You see those stairs that would kind of sweep you up to this larger space that's kind of got an organic shape. That space was about for exhibitions. And so people, when they see the exhibitions, they're wandering here and wandering there. It's a very flowing, organic movement. So the building takes that kind of shape. In the back up there, there are conference rooms. And then on the right, there's some individual offices. Those are very different kind of functions. They're more static functions. They're more contained functions. So it's reasonable that they would be more rectangular and more static than this more dynamic shape in the center. And in the three-dimensional expression of that, on the right, you see that exhibition space kind of getting a higher ceiling, getting a more shapy, focal kind of quality to it. And then the conference rooms being a little more reticent, more ordinary in the back. Exactly according to his values, that function is the driver here, what's going on where, and that there is an expression of that function. This would be true very much in the houses that he did as well. So in this case, we have a couple of plans of houses he did. And they look kind of wacky, don't they? I mean, is this a guy drunk? Is he on drugs? I mean, these are, it's like his cat plopped down and he just drew the outline of the cat there or something. But in fact, these are very, very carefully crafted plans. Every aspect of the function is considered very carefully. So when you would come in the front door here, immediately on the side would be, in good German fashion, a little sink and a little toilet so you could clean up before you went into the rest of the house, that good German cleanliness. Even this little toilet space. So what happens when you're sitting on the pot? Okay, you sit like this. If you think of the shape of your body, there's a kind of convex shape of your rear as you sit there. And that convex shape is completely reflected in this concave shape of the back of the toilet. It's almost like physiognomy. So let me read you a few things he said. These are quotes from Hugo Herring. He said, "The architectural image can only be discovered through a study of function. I want to examine things to allow them to discover their own images. I'm not imposing some image, I'm finding it in the function." He says, architecture petrifies and lays down once and for all the movement of life. And as regards these houses in particular, he said, a house may be bred out of the forms arising from work performance. The house may be looked upon as man's second skin, and hence a bodily organ. So just like your hand expresses the function hand, it allows you to pick things up. It allows you to touch someone. That shape of your hand is all about the function a hand is supposed to do. Likewise, the shape of your knee is made out of an expression of the joint and the function and the movement of that part. So can I make a house that is like a second skin for life? It's just an extension of your body, and it takes on expression of function in exactly the same way our bodies do. So once you entered that house, there's a little area over here around the fireplace, and it's very cozy. This is a place you'd be in the wintertime, a nice banquette seat there that takes you right up to the fireplace, very cozy little nook, place to actually work at a little desk next to the fireplace, thinking really about the activities and behavior of the house. Very different area over here. This family was very into music, so there's a piano, and there's a place to listen to people playing the piano. But that's a very different feeling, where there's glass and you look out to the garden and there's a little music nook over here. The kitchen in this is fantastic. You have to think, this would have been in a period where a kitchen would have had a big stove and a big refrigerator and maybe a little work table. But he envisioned a kitchen another way. This could be like a reflection of exactly how you work in a kitchen. So you need to have a sink and a place to clean up. You need to have a cooking area. But really what you need is this continuous flow of being able to do this activity, chop these vegetables, put them in the pan to cook them, take the dish away, put it in the sink to clean it. There's this continuous flow. So the counter was not, right angles, but this continuous flow of work there. And then this island in the center where you could go back and prepare the things and store them as you started to take them to the dining room where people would eat later. So every piece is thought of in terms of exactly what the function is. And likewise, this little study over here, that's a completely different function. Now this is not the public flowing part of the house. It's a much more privatized individual space. And he's got a perfect little place to sit at a desk. You have the window that's letting light come into your desk. Most people are right-handed, so the light is not going to be obscured by your arm. You're going to be able to write at the desk and still have the light come in there. Storage area behind that. So a very different kind of space for a very different kind of function there. Another quotation from Hugo Herring, he says, life is given to a building by awakening, fostering, and cultivating the essential form that's enclosed within. If we just understand these functions, they'll tell us exactly what shapes the building should be. And that happens in three dimensions as well as two dimensions. The general shape of the building is kind of bulgy and maybe even a little awkward. I mean, it's an agglomeration of lots of bits and parts. But then inside this staircase that just says exactly what you're doing, you're ascending. And the kind of flow and the character of the rail, everything is about ascending up that staircase. So it's about function and expression of function. This is one of the most extensive buildings that, or complex of buildings that Hugo Herring did. It's actually a big farm in Garkau, which is on the northern coast of Germany near Lübeck. It's called Gutgarkau. And it was a whole complex of building for a farm family, all of that. And there we see it in three dimensions. And even the sort of siting of the buildings and the relationship of one building to the other is driven by function. So this is the house for the family right here. You would have come in, and there's the house. You come in the driveway. There's the house right there. That's where the family would live. And each of the little bits and pieces of the house, their functions are very carefully arranged there. This piece right there is the hen house. So the woman of the house, most of her duties would have been here, but she would have taken care of the hens. So the hens and the egg production is close to the domestic part of the complex, the house. This is the granary. That's the place where when you brought in grain and you stored it there to feed all of the animals, that would make it very close to the area where the pigs are right here, the area where the horses are right here, and the area where the cows are right there. So all of them need grain, and they could be, that could be gotten to them very easily. So it's close to where it's delivered, and it's close to then where it's needed right there. This is the tool shed and the shed for the machinery and vehicles. That means when the guys of the house are going out to work in the field, they go by the area, they pick up their farm equipment and machinery, and they go out to the farming areas out here. The pigs are here near the water because you need water to slop the pigs. So there's a lake right here. Pigs are near that. The horses and the cows are near the fields where they graze, which are out here. So they're in the right location. And right up there, that's the dung heap where all the shit from all these other things gets collected. And of course, the dung heap is the farthest away from the house, for obvious reasons, because it's smelly. So everything is in exactly the right place. And that's how you design. You think of function, and the function drives everything. And there it is in three dimensions: the house, the hen house, the granary, the horses, the pigs, the cows, the tool shed, all of those with their own three-dimensional shape that also has to do with the function of those buildings. Now, we're going to hone in on the cow barn, and we're going to do that because I know about cows. I don't know so much about pigs and horses, but I grew up on a farm where we had cattle. And so I can look at the design of this, and holy moly, it's unbelievable how carefully this is designed to the nature of a cow and the nature of the function that's going on there. So what's happening here is this is a dairy operation. So they have to bring in the cows twice a day and milk the cows. And you know, you can imagine what a ordeal that is. Early in the morning you get up, you bring all the cows in, you milk all the cows, you take that milk to market. It has to be done very quickly because it'll spoil. Then late in the afternoon again, you go out and you bring the cows in, you milk them again, day after day after day. So there are two things you need to understand about cows that clearly Hugo Herring understood. One is that cows play follow the leader. They're extremely stupid animals. They're way more stupid than pigs or horses. These are really, really dumb animals. And the way you get a cow to do to go where you want them to go is you get the lead cow doing that, and then all the other cows follow, pretty much in single file. That's how they like to go. Not in a clump or a herd, but pretty much in single file. So if you can get them coming in from the fields and in single file, that's the best way it works. The second thing you need to understand about them is just the way a cow's body is built. They can't pivot. They can't make a right turn or a left turn. And that's very different from the way a horse's body is put together. A horse on four legs can go like this, and then they can pivot on that right leg and make a left turn on a dime, or pivot on that left leg and make a right turn on a dime. A cow cannot do that. They cannot pivot. Just the way their legs are attached, if you want a cow to turn left, you have to get them going forward and then very, very slowly get them moving just a little at a time left. And they'll finally get there. And I know that because we showed our cows on 4-H at the damn county fair, and you had to get them to lead around a ring, which cows do not want to do. Puppy dogs get on a leash and go fine, but cows, dumb. They don't want to do that. But if you really, really work at it, you can make those cows move like that. But you can't get them, if you've got a halter on them, and you're pulling them ahead like this, and then you pull that halter this way, their neck will go like this and go like this and go like this. They don't know what to do. Their feet stay just like that. The only way you can get them to move that way is that you move them slowly forward and then they can move very, very slowly around and make a left turn. It's just the way their bodies are built. So taking those two characteristics in mind, he makes this place where the cows come in from the fields. There's the cow barn right there. Here are the fields where they're grazing. They come in single file, and he sends them into the building in single file like this, and then never makes any abrupt turns, very slow turns all the way around and out like that. It's genius. Because if he tried to make a right turn, the cows would balk, they'd stop, they'd clump up, they'd run into each other because they're too dumb to know to stop. And pretty soon they'd be hurting each other and you'd have injuries and you'd have damage and it would not work at all. But this makes it work very, very nicely. So then you get the cows in. There are two little moo cows right there. You have their feed in that trough right there. And that's where the human beings are in that trough. They take the hay from the hay loft over here and bring it in and feed it to the cows. Or they take the grain from the granary over here and bring it in and feed it to the cows. And there's an area that the cows cannot get to right there. And then they milk the cows from this side, and then they take that milk and they put it in the milk storage area right there, and then eventually deliver it out to the truck that takes it away. It's just like a little machine. It is so beautifully attuned to function. And then each of those pieces and parts, the shape of it has to do with function again. So that area where the hay is stored, there's a hay loft up here. You throw the hay down to this area right there, and then it's spread out on the lower level right here and then taken to the cows. But the one thing you don't want to happen when you're storing hay is you don't want to leave the hay there for a couple of days on the floor where it's damp. Then the hay will start to mildew. And if it mildews, the cows won't eat it. So you want to constantly move all the hay out and feed it to cows and completely clean that floor up. So what you're doing with the hay is you're pitching it with a fork, a pitchfork. And your body is designed so that I can pitch it this way and this way and this way and this way. But if there were a corner back there, it would be hard for me to get back there and get the hay. So he makes a room that doesn't have a corner. It is a reflection of that kind of radial shape of the way I operate in my body when I stand here and pitch the hay around that way. Same way with the granary here. You don't want any of that grain staying on the floor and getting mildewy, so you don't want any corners. You want it all to be easy to clean and deliver to the cows. So the shape of this, the shape of that, the shape of this, everything has to do with function. And in the end, we get a building that is a reflection of all those in three dimensions. This is the hay loft. You store the hay up here. You pitch it down. It then is that boat shape there that you can gather all the hay and take it in there. The windows all have to do with function. That strip of windows right there is exactly at human eye height. And it's just a little thin strip. So I can see, did any stray cows stay out there? What's the weather like? Is it going to be stormy? You need to know these things. You need to be connected to the outdoors. But no window at cow eye height, because cows get distracted very easily, so it's a solid wall at their height. Every freaking piece of this building is about understanding the function and how it works, and then it reflects that. Even the materials of the building, basically, barns in this part of Germany are made of two materials, and you know by the material what this function is. They're either made of red brick, kind of crude red brick, or they're made of board and batten wood siding. And so the barn, the cow barn here, is made of brick and board and batten wood siding. So the point is that this is a man who has very clear values. He comes to this design problem. It's indeterminate. He's bringing the values to the problem, and the values are helping him shape the character of the design. Okay, this is a Twitter card question coming up here. Are you sympathetic with these values? Should function drive design quite so thoroughly? What about these kind of strange, organic, amorphous shapes. Is that what function produces? If so, is that good? Is that not so good? I mean, just think about this. Okay. Next guy we talked about, Mies van der Rohe. Told you, tall, elegant guy. This is when he was an old guy, but still kind of elegant. He, in his early career, was doing these really boxy buildings. And they're really all about technology. So this one on the left is a reinforced concrete building, and it's all about the very efficiency of making a reinforced concrete frame. And the one on the right is a steel building, and you can see that steel frame. So he's all about what's it made out of, and what kind of shape does that make? And when you take pieces of steel and you make a frame out of them, it makes a rectangular building. And we look at these and think, gosh, that looks like every building on the freeway in Houston. But the truth is, it's Mies van der Rohe that invented the sort of office building, very efficient, very technology-driven office building in the 1920s and 1930s. And all those buildings on the freeway were greatly influenced by his work. This is a building he did pretty early in his career in Germany in 1929. It was a building for an exhibition, a kind of world's fair that was happening in Barcelona. And this was the German pavilion. Now, this plan on the left, you can see that's very different from the plans that we saw of Hugo Herring. In fact, that really is meant to, he said, is meant to accommodate many different functions. I don't know what functions exactly are going to go on here. And in fact, that was true. Sometimes it had exhibitions, and there were like stanchions and, you know, placards and things like that that are being exhibited through here. And one time, the King and Queen of Spain came, and there was a reception for the King and Queen of Spain in this space. And they sat on kind of thrones here, not exactly, but sort of, and the people gathered around and paid homage to them. So it isn't driven by function. It's driven in part by the technology of it, which is a series of planes, walls like that, and a series of columns like that, a grid of columns, and these elegant stainless steel columns and these long, thin stone walls. It's really about the structure and the construction and the materials. That's what's making the architectural form. And there you see those beautiful marble and granite walls. Glass infill between those, the simple plane of the roof. On the left is that room where there was sometimes an exhibition, but sometimes a reception for the King and Queen of Spain. Very luminous, kind of milky glass wall on one side, beautifully book-matched marble wall on the other side, that elegant stainless steel column right there. All about construction materials, not so much about function. There are several quotations from Mies van der Rohe I should read to you. So he is famous for doing kind of minimal architecture. He invented the phrase, less is more. Less is more. You do the minimum that you have to do, and there's a certain generosity in that. So he said, sorry about that. He said, the architect should, like a gardener, bind the tender plant of life to a grid or trellis, giving it support, and by that very fact, freedom. Why would you want to make walls around functions that are so tight it's like a straitjacket? Just make it like a trellis. So you have a light framework there, and then the tender plant of life can grow whatever way it wants to do. It's flexible. It's malleable. Hugo Herring and he, like I said, they're working in the same room. There's a story one time he comes over to Hugo Herring's desk and Hugo Herring is sweating bullets trying to make this thing that just exactly fits the function. And he said, Hugo, just make it a little bigger and they can do anything. So why? I mean, people can do anything in that space. So his idea was that architecture should not be driven by function. This is a house that he designed. It's called the Brick Villa. It's very interesting that he named it according to what its made out of, which is brick. So the idea is that brick is this masonry earthen material, and you build it out of the ground and you make this little low retaining wall there, and then all of the walls come out of the ground, this earthen material emerging from the earth, and they're very heavy and they're very solid. And the way you get an opening is there's a void between two of these solid walls. And all of these walls are what's really shaping the architectural character of the building, this combination of walls and spaces between walls. Now, if you look at that plan of the brick villa, I challenge you to tell me, where is the freaking bathroom? I don't know. Nobody knows, actually. There's absolutely no indication. I mean, maybe that's a bathroom, maybe that's a bathroom. Maybe the bathtub's right in the middle of the room. I don't know. We don't know. It doesn't say anything about function. Where's the kitchen? I don't have a clue. What's a bedroom? I don't know. It's not really driven by function. And he doesn't express it as functional at all. Another house he did in that same period out of brick, this is the Lang House. Every dimension in that whole building is set by the dimension of the brick. And everything is a module of that brick. And it is this very careful construction of brick, and just brick walls, brick floors, brick everywhere. And that's what's shaping the architecture. He did a whole campus when he immigrated to the United States at what's now Illinois Institute of Technology, IIT, in Chicago. And many, many buildings on the campus done over a period of 20, 25 years. But they're all in the same vocabulary, all this steel frame with brick and glass infill between it. That little building right there is the power plant. Just off this slide, there's a building that's almost identical size and proportion that is the chapel. And in a way, you could say, you know, that could be the chapel. There's a steeple. They're identical almost. But it didn't really matter whether it was a power plant or whether it was a chapel. It was a bit of technology. It was a steel frame, and then it had infill of, in this case, pretty much all glass. In this case, some glass and some brick, so that there might be some variations in that. But basically, every building on the campus was an expression of technology. And it's Illinois Institute of Technology. And there is a kind of the rigor of the repetitive steel frame and the flexibility of, okay, it's a lab for 10 years, but then you don't need the lab anymore. It becomes classrooms, can be renovated for that. It's all modular. And there is a certain sensibility to that over a long life of a building as well. This is one of the most famous buildings that Mies van der Rohe did. It's a tiny little house for Edith Farnsworth, the Farnsworth House, done outside of Chicago in a little town called Plano, Illinois, in 1945. And you can see this house is basically, it's in a rural area. Actually, it's by a river, and the river floods sometimes, so it's built up on stilts so that it won't flood. It's got a big outdoor terrace there, which is right there, and then it's got a big covered patio there, which is right there. And then inside, it's just kind of one room. And it has little bathroom, two little bathrooms and a kitchen in a kind of pod right there. But then there's a place where your bed and your clothes can be stored in a kind of living area, a little dining room. But it's all just one big space, and then floor-to-ceiling glass, looking out this beautiful forest and the river, and yeah, actually very, very beautiful, beautiful space. On the left, you can see when the Fox River flooded, and that's fine. Then the house stays above that. And then in more temperate times, it's just this simple, almost like being outdoors, because you're floor-to-ceiling glass, and you can just connect to this lovely site by the river. Everything in the building is about its technology of building. It's a steel frame building, although it's a simple little house. It's made out of a steel frame, steel columns right there, and we see them supporting the steel beam, but we see it very explicitly, the role of the column, the role of the beam. Even the stair, we see the stringer made out of steel. We see then the supports and the slabs of stone that span across there. Everything is like tinker toys. It can be disassembled, reassembled in our mind, we know about the technology of building. Because he's in a machine age. He's in an age where technology, machine technology, is driving things. And that expression of his age is very important to him. On the inside, as you can see on the slide on the right, just this one big room, floor-to-ceiling glass all the way around, easy movement of space between there. And why do you need all these walls and separations? It's just one woman living there. She doesn't have, you know, kids or even a husband or anyone who she needs to be private from. So it's just one simple space. And there's that column made out of a wide flange section of steel that you see right there. Every bit of the forces of the gravity and moving through that, all of it expressed in the technology of the building. So again, a very coherent set of values shaping the architecture, and a completely different kind of architecture than what we saw from Hugo Herring. Okay, this third guy is Albert Speer. And Speer, as I said, rose to prominence at a very early age. Super successful, until the crash came when they lost the war. This guy was the absolute top of his field, making very large income, a real leader of the elite top of government in Germany at the time. As I said, he got that job by Hitler's other architect that dropped dead of a heart attack. They searched around, they found this young architect. Hitler said, okay, give him a chance on this small project. So he had this project where Hitler was going to give a big speech. And Hitler, because he understood architecture, he was savvy, Hitler said, you know, I have to have a really great setting for my rallies. If I'm going to really make an impression on people, I've got to have a rally that has the right setting. And so he tells Speer, I want you to make a setting that will just knock people's socks off, that will they'll come to this rally, they'll be so impressed, they'll walk away saying, yes for Hitler, yes for the Third Reich, you know, we're behind you. So this rally was going to involve a big military parade, all of the military bands playing, the troops marching in, the artillery marching in to this big parade ground here, this big parade ground here. And then there would be these big stands up here where all of Hitler's entourage would be, all of his followers. There would be a big place for him to speak right there on loudspeakers, and he was a fantastic speaker. He was very charismatic, and so he would then project this rousing speech to all of these people, but he had to have a setting that would make him seem bigger than life. So Speer designs all of these banners that are in the red and black and white of Nazi Germany with the swastika on there. But the real kicker here was that he gathered 130 Klieglights. These Klieglights were huge, high-intensity lamps that were used to search the skies for enemy planes. They were military devices. The only time we ever see them these days is occasionally, like at an opening of something, they'll shoot these things in the sky, and there are these huge beams of light that come out of these Klieglights. So they had all of them for military purposes. But he gathered them from all over where they were assigned, brought 130 to the site, and he lined the whole parade ground with these Klieglights and pointed them straight up in the sky and turned them on. And so this was in the middle of the day. And then as people came, 5, 6 o'clock in the evening, you know, as it got dark, you began to see that light going up in the sky. And then as it got darker and darker, the beams of light got stronger and stronger, and people found themselves within this cathedral of light, and it just knocked their socks off. And it was a hugely successful rally. It was incredibly dramatic, and Hitler said, Albert, babe, you're my man. And from then on, Albert Speer was Hitler's architect. One of the first projects he did was this big rally ground for the Nazi party in Nuremberg. It was comprised of a huge stadium and a big conference center and two rally grounds, one here and one here. That stadium would have been, it would seat 400,000 people. Memorial Stadium seats 100,000, four times the size of that big dog over there. It was 1,800 feet long, that's six football fields long, and 1,500 feet wide, six football fields wide. It was 3.5 times the volume of the pyramids at Cheops. It was a big, amazing stadium. Construction started on it, they got a little ways into it, but then they had to stop it when the war took over. They did, however, complete several projects on the grounds. This is one of those rally sites here, and you can see it's very classical. You get a sense of ancient Greece and Rome there. That's how it would have been originally. This is how it was several years ago when I visited the ruins of that site. That would have been that rally ground. This is the conference center. While these buildings were under construction, Hitler and Speer were out on the construction site one day, kind of supervising things. And they were so proud that, the Third Reich is going to live into posterity. And 1,000 years from now, people are going to be able to see the nobility and the power of Nazi Germany. And these buildings are going to be the exemplars of that. But then they started thinking about, they were building these buildings out of reinforced concrete, which means you have steel rebars inside the concrete. And they thought, okay, when the building starts to fall apart, what's that going to look like? Oh, damn. The steel will rust, and there'll be rust stains on the concrete. This is not going to make beautiful ruins. We can't do this anymore. So they stopped building in reinforced concrete, and they started building in solid stone, just for the reason that in 1,000 years, it will make beautiful ruins if we build it in solid stone. So this conference center is made out of solid granite, big granite blocks for the entire building. It's pretty much was derelict when I was there, so it is beginning to be a ruin. You can see the glass is knocked out, but built to last forever. This is another one of those parade grounds and slide on the right, as it was originally, and slide on the left when I visited it. And in fact, it's making rather beautiful ruins. It actually looks kind of powerful and strong and romantic like they wanted. One of the biggest complexes he completed was the new state chancellery. This was Hitler's own headquarters. It was meant to talk about power. So you come in the front door here, you go through this courtyard, you go through another vestibule, into a grand hall, through the rotunda, down the great concourse, finally to a conference room in Hitler's office. So you're going through one portal, through another important transition, and then you move into this hall that's all, you know, bookmatched marble, beautiful inlaid stone, incredibly impressive. Click, 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 down the marble halls, through the rotunda, into the grand gallery with the light spilling on one side, great ancient tapestries on the other side, and finally to Hitler's conference room on the right or his office on the left. And by the time you get there, he has communicated to you, this is a great man. You are dealing with greatness here by the architectural orchestration of that space. Now, Berlin was meant to have exactly that same effect on visitors, that you would know that this is a great city. And they had this huge plan for redoing Berlin. All of what's in black was the existing city, and they were completely transforming the center of the city here. They were building a new airport, a new train terminal, a great triumphal arch there that went down a huge avenue to the main Capitol building. There's that arch and the avenue going down to the Capitol building. The avenue is 2.5 times the length of the Champs-Élysées in Paris, this grand boulevard. The Capitol building itself is the real blow-away. This dome is 16 times the volume of St. Peter's that we saw last time. 16 times the volume. The diameter is 5 times the diameter of St. Peter's. This whole complex of buildings, that is the what's now called the Reichstag, which is the capital of Germany. It's about the size of our Capitol building down the street. If you imagine that as the Texas State Capitol, that's the size of the building they were doing. It was 726 feet tall. You could have fit a 60-story building inside the dome. It would have 150 to 180,000 people that could gather there, but they just occupied that little space, and all of that is just pure knock-you-on-your-ass volume. You can see some tiny little specks of people down here. It's about wonder and awe and drama. It's about communicating something about the power of the Third Reich. These are the values that Albert Speer brought. Okay, you can see these three architects, three sets of values. As your Twitter card response, give me just a sentence or two. What kinds of things would you believe in architecture? What do you think are important, and why would that be the case?